Coast.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and you know what? I'm going to get out over my skis and talk about basketball. And there's a reason for that. It appears that a deal is in place to sell the Portland Trailblazers. And if you listen to this show on a regular basis, you know I don't talk about sports very much because I know less than zero about sports. But I am concerned about the effect this is going to have if the Trailblazers stay in Portland, if they don't. Since the city now owns the arena where they play ball, I'm concerned about the 75% of Americans who don't regularly watch NBA basketball games. I don't mean go to them. I mean 75% of Americans do not routinely watch NBA ball games. So to them, the biggest concern, I would think, would be whether or not the city of Portland has put itself in line to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to renovate a stadium that they bought last year for a dollar. They bought the Moda Center for a dollar. Now they paid $7 million for the land underneath the Moda Center, but they bought the arena for a dollar. And I questioned the deal at the time it went down. But let me get into all the details of what's happened. We are hearing today there is a tentative deal to sell to the owner of the NHL Hurricanes, Tom Dundon. And apparently it's $4 billion is the cost of that deal. But the cost to taxpayers, that may run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And I don't think that's the way it should go. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We proudly serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we provide honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. If you want to jump into the conversation, you're always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And naysayers on this program, especially on a day when I do something as crazy as talking about any kind of sports, I'm glad to take the naysayer calls. You'll go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Now, our ex-poll question today. Donald Trump has said not only is he going to clean up crime in Washington, D.C., he's going to clean the streets of the so-called homeless, most of them drug and alcohol addicted, as they are in just about every major city in America. The thing I like best about this, while I wish that President Trump would spend a whole lot more of his time and attention on the Pacific Northwest, he hasn't spent much time at all on Oregon or Washington or Idaho. I'd love to see him clean up the crime problem there, because if he shows how to get it done there, then maybe we can get it across to some of the knuckleheads who are currently occupying political office in Oregon and Washington, in Seattle and in Portland, and say that's the way to get it done. Now, what I kind of hope, I know, hope in one hand, spit in the other, see which one fills up first. But if you had enterprising reporters, I'd be glad to talk to Bruce Harrell, mayor of Seattle, and ask him this question. And the same to Keith Wilson, who's only been on this show one time, but he's invited all the time to come on. I'd love to ask him, if Donald Trump cleans up the homeless problem with this approach that I'm about to tell you about, is it possible you could do the same kind of thing for Seattle, for Portland, for Spokane, for Eugene, for Medford, and every other city that has a giant population of homeless who are, number one, in a bad situation? I don't think it's compassionate to leave people out living on the streets. I don't think it's compassionate to leave people who are drug and alcohol addicted untreated. I also think it's dangerous. We are hearing about more and more shootings, robberies, rapes, sexual assault. We're seeing drug dealing. We're seeing drug overdose deaths. All of those things are bad, and I think they ought to be addressed. And they can't be addressed as long as the Northwest has taken the position Give them tents. Give them tarps. Let them live on the streets. Let them bring their filth to the streets. And the rest of us just have to pay the bill and put up with it. Here's the Trump approach. Should every American city take the approach to the homeless? You have three choices: treatment, shelter, or jail. That's it. No other choices. Treatment, shelter, or jail. Now, if somebody thinks that that is unkind toward the homeless, tell me why. If you've got somebody who's living on the streets, probably because of a drug or alcohol problem or mental illness, how is it uncompassionate to say to them, we want to offer you treatment, you can take that. We will offer you shelter, you can take that. Or you can take jail. One of those three, the alternative, just continuing to live on the streets, is not going to be there. You can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, here's what I'd like to hear from you. First of all, the numbers. I looked them up, brand new numbers this morning. 24% of American adults regularly watch NBA basketball games, either in person, on TV, or streaming. That's 24%. That means that more than 75% of American adults do not regularly watch NBA basketball games. You might watch one now and then, but it is not part of your regular entertainment. So, you've got 75% of the population that doesn't watch the games. You have a small number of businesses that will do very, very well. Restaurants, bars, parking facilities, they'll benefit from the presence of the Trailblazers, and they do right now. City of Portland is going to be anxious to hang on to the Blazers. But let me give you a couple of disturbing numbers. 1 year ago, the city of Portland, in an absolutely foolish deal, decided to buy the Moda Center, the arena that was built with Paul Allen's money, mostly $262 million, $34 million of that from the city of Portland to pay for the sidewalks and the streets around it. But most of the $250 million came from Paul Allen. Now, does the new owner have to worry about that? He does not. If this deal goes through, he will go to the city of Portland and say, that Moda Center, it's 30 years old. And I have four more years on a five-year deal. I have agreed that we'll keep the Blazers there until four and a half years from now. But then, do you want me to stay in town? He's going to tell the city, and I can guarantee you, he's going to tell the city of Portland, you own that place right now. You gave up $1.2 million a year in property taxes when you took ownership of that facility, and now you have to renovate it. What is the typical renovation cost for an NBA arena? I looked that up as well. It can be very small. It typically runs about $400 million. So here's what the city of Portland will do. They're saying, we're desperate to hang on to the Trailblazers. The new owner says, if you don't renovate that old shack, the Moda Center, then I'm going to be inclined to take the team somewhere else. Right now, Tom Dundon says, I plan to keep the Blazers here. How much do you think that plan will change if the city does not pour hundreds of millions of dollars into renovating the Moda Center that it now owns and does not collect property taxes on since it bought it a year ago? I would say they've got a gigantic incentive to spend your money to renovate that stadium. Is that the job of taxpayers to do? I would say no. Back in a moment. It's Wednesday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. With everything.
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know he got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
So you might have heard that 2 weeks from now, or Oregon holds a special session to do the work that lawmakers couldn't seem to get done in the six-month regular session that they just ended a few weeks ago. Think about that for just a moment, and then think about Governor Tina Kotek using the following sleazy tactics to threaten taxpayers that she supposedly serves. You announce that you're laying off hundreds of ODOT workers and that the things people depend on the most, things like solid roads and plowed snow in the wintertime, will disappear if taxes don't go up dramatically. How would you like to have that gun to your head? And then you delay the layoffs to the end of the special session. Message received. Give us more money or else. Kotek is like that nightmare contractor who doesn't get the job done on time and then demands more money or he's walking away to leave you sitting in the mess. In the meantime, check out ODOT's job postings. Two of them jumped out at me. Project Delivery Administrator 3. A paper pusher from the corner office. And the gig lets you work from home at least part of the time. Salary up to $250,000 per year. Director of External Affairs is another one. Whatever the Director of External Affairs is, maybe it has something to do with, you know, the Kiss Cam and going to a concert. Salary up to $200,000 a year. Both of them plus benefits, generous vacation, and a PERS pension. So, ODOT is still hiring those white-collar jobs, even while it pleads poverty to actually fund the paychecks of the blue-collar folks who do the jobs we care about the most. Call your state lawmakers and demand that they tell Kotek and company to live within their means, well, in this case, their means is our means, and that you don't appreciate their extortionate tactics. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com, and naysayers always go to the head of the line. Now, Anna Buckley writes in, Lars, I drive I-84 from Sunday through Thursday to Pasco from Portland. I have for 3 years. When Biden was in office, I saw a lot of transportation of windmill blades down I-84. Then when Trump came in, it stopped. But this past week, I've seen a lot of transportation again. I was under the assumption we're no longer funding the wind and solar projects. Is that true? And if so, why are they again piloting the blades down I-84? Signed, Anna. Anna, what they've done is Donald Trump has pretty much put the kibosh to all the windmill projects, but the current existing contracts are going to have to wind down first. You're still likely to see a few of those blades rolling down the highway. If it wasn't happening when Trump first came in January and February, it was likely because inclement weather makes it really difficult to move those things on the highways. My favorite post on X today, Christian Collins points out 173 House Democrats backed a law in Washington, D.C. to reduce penalties for the following: murders, sexual assault, robberies, carjackings, home invasions. Democrats are pro-criminal and is why they're against Donald Trump's efforts to make the Capitol safe again. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the Washington State Department of Corrections. Now, it's their job to hang on to convicted criminals. Except lately, they sound like they've got fumble fingers. A prisoner managed to escape from DOC officers on the parking garage at SeaTac Airport. That happened on Tuesday night. The prisoner, identified as John Nino, fled from two DOC officers, made a getaway to the light rail station, and it isn't the first time it happened. May the 4th, Cedric Stevenson fled the terminal as an agent was trying to take him back to Bowling Green, Kentucky, to face three new charges. He boarded a light rail train, not exactly a high-speed getaway, and disappeared for more than a month until he was captured by, not Seattle PD, but by U.S. Marshals at an apartment complex on First Hill in Seattle. Today's best email, you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it myself. I've had them do it for me. They do fantastic work. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP-THAT. Alan writes in, Lars, Here's a question. If a person's in an accident with another person and the person hit has no insurance and no license, how does that play out from a legal perspective? Just happened to a friend of mine. They're still waiting to hear from the insurance company. Unfortunately, it happened in Portland, land of not holding guilty parties accountable. In reality, the uninsured and unlicensed person should have been on the, should never have been on the road, but Portland's justice system will come to their defense. I guess we'll see. Thanks, Lars. Signed, Alan. To your calls now. Let me start with Dave, who's got a comment about the sale of the Portland Trailblazers. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I did call about the Trailblazers, but I just want to say that it sounds like the upcoming legislative session is going to be anything but special.
No kidding.
Yeah. Hey, I live in the Rogue Valley now, but I lived in Portland for a long time. I still have some friends up there that are fairly close to the situation. And, you know, I think, you know, this is the thing with the Blazers has been in the wind for a while now, but I'm hearing
I'm hearing
this owner wants to take the team to Seattle. Seattle's chomping at the bit to get an NBA franchise back. I know Portland would want to keep the Trailblazers. And I could be wrong. I don't know if that's accurate, but I'm hearing that's a fairly plausible and likely outcome to this.
Well, except Dave, I don't know that anybody can say. The guy who's going to spend $4 billion along with his partners to buy the team, wouldn't you imagine he's going to say to Portland, I might stick around. Tell me what kind of place we're going to be playing in. Are you going to build it up nice? Because it's a 30-year-old arena, so that's about the age when arenas have to get a makeover. If Portland promises the sun, moon, and the stars to the new owner of the Blazers, they may stay. If he goes to Seattle and says, what are you going to offer me? Do you think anybody just going in where the deal isn't even done yet would say ahead of time, I am going to Seattle? Because then your bargaining power goes away. If he goes to Seattle and says, I might come there, tell me what I'm going to get. Do I get the parking concession? Do I get the other concessions? What kind of break are you going to give me on the fees going into the arena? Are you going to do any fix-up? I don't know that it would be Key Arena in Seattle where they'd be playing. I'm not sure. But in any case, wouldn't you think he'd bargain with both cities? And the city that offers him the sweetest deal is going to be the home of the Blazers.
Well, that's possible, Lars, but the other thing is I'm looking at it. Seattle is just a much bigger market. It's a much bigger sporting market. It's a much larger
city. That's all true.
And let's face it. They've got Major League Baseball. They've got the NFL in Seattle. They want the NBA back. In Portland, you basically have the NBA that's been there forever. And, you know, look at over the past few years, the Trailblazers really haven't been in contention, you know, for a long time.
I get your point, but in some ways you made the argument against yourself, because do you have an unlimited amount of money to spend on your entertainment, or do most people have an unlimited amount of money? Which means if you're in Seattle, you can say, I'm going to watch a baseball game. I'm going to go to this. I'm going to go to a hockey game. I'll go watch football. So you've got all these alternatives. In Portland, you got one thing. Unless you consider soccer something worth watching, you've got one alternative. It might actually be a more attractive a marketplace for that. But I'll bet he's going to go for the best deal.
Lars Larson Show. He does the work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I don't want to make this too complicated. I think it comes down to this. When you have public meetings of public bodies like the legislature or a city council or county commission, they have to be made in front of the public. And there are strict rules about that. And then what happens when you find out that one of the newest governments for an old city, the city of Portland, but a brand new government of 12 city council members has a big group that constitutes half of the entire city council that is communicating in secret among themselves? What should we make of that? Aaron Mesh joins me now from Willamette Week. He's the managing editor, and you can find the stories at WWeek.com. Aaron, you've called this the Peacock Papers, and I think it's very revealing what you found out.
Thanks. So I should credit immediately that it's what Sophie Peel found out through a records request. But I'm delighted she found it for us. So Peacock, by the way, is said just like and spelled just like the bird. It's it's not an acronym. It's just a shorthand for Progressive Caucus. So it's the six most left-leaning members of Portland City Council who had a text thread, basically a Slack thread, that they were engaged in and typing into in real time while the council hearings were occurring. So essentially what that means is that while six of their colleagues and the public were watching one meeting, there were actually two meetings occurring simultaneously. So I think it's important to know that these messages were not being exchanged mostly back at home during the evenings after council. They were being exchanged while all 12 councilors were on the dais debating the budget, which means that six of those 12 were having a second meeting simultaneously.
Is that legal?
It probably is, meaning that unless there was a seventh member inside that channel, there wasn't a caucus. So therefore, they are allowed to engage in communications with a group that is smaller than a caucus. Whether or not it is...
Can I try to bust that one, Aaron? I want to try and bust that. I understand what you're saying, because when they used to have five city council members, or any city that does, if three of them get together for a barbecue, they can do that, but they can't talk business at all because three of the five makes a quorum. But when they're sitting there with the other members of the council, they are in a quorum. I mean, there is a quorum present, except they're communicating secretly. So if you say these meetings are required to be made in front of the public with public notice, you know, I think 24 hours might be the minimum they need, and that the meeting has to be done in public. If six of them are communicating in private while all 12 of them are sitting there, aren't they violating the public meetings law? Because you're having half the meeting, as you point out of view. And you could have one council member saying to the other one, I'm not willing to go for your plan. And then if the other council member says, well, what if I do this? I'll add some more money to the department you oversee or your pet cause. And they make a secret, they make a deal, but they're doing it while all 12 of them are sitting there. Is that legal? Does that still constitute a public meeting? Or is the public being denied a window into how are these deals being made?
Well, certainly the public is being denied a window in how these deals are being made. Whether or not it's legal is something that we're still trying to figure out. As far as I can tell, it does not appear to violate public meetings law, despite it seeming to violate the spirit of public meetings law. I am eager, however, to see a government ethics commission ruling on this at some point that actually tells me whether or not your interpretation of this is correct. Believe me, I'm not arguing with you because I'm like, oh, I love it. They should keep doing this a lot. I just can't go on the radio with you and tell you that I think it's illegal when I don't have any indication at this time that it is.
No, I understand that. And Aaron, all I'm saying is it would be true that if all six were sitting in their living rooms by themselves, but they're having this meeting of six, they can do it, sit and do that because those six are not a quorum. The minute they're all correct, sitting in the same room, they constitute a quorum, or the whole group constitutes a quorum, except half the group is communicating out of public view while appearing to be in public view because they're sitting in the room in front of whatever audience there is in the gallery. The public has a right to see what's going on, and these six are denying it. They also have a kind of an odd attitude about what their role is, and you dealt with that in the story. Would you mind speaking to that, the disruptor idea?
I'd love to. Let me offer one counterpoint on the quorum issue that I think is okay, important, and then we'll jump into the content real quick. The counterpoint would be that if, say, back in the day when there was only five councilors or five commissioners, that back in the day they would get together in the hallway and two of them would hash out a deal, right? That's like less than a quorum.
They
would hash out the deal together in the hallway, and that's legal. So the question is whether or not it would be legal for them to hash out that deal quietly while they're still in the room. Because essentially that's or text each other while they're still in the room. That's the question that we're facing. Now, as for what the content of the messages contain, I don't think it would be a terrible surprise to any of your listeners to learn that that the six commissioners, the counselors, excuse me, in Peacock view themselves as change agents and to some degree revolutionaries. That they view the workings of city government as having been tilted toward benefiting the wealthy, and they don't like the Portland Police Bureau. I can't imagine that you're going to sit there and gasp in shock at any of that from the Democratic Socialists of America.
Nope. But what have they actually accomplished? I mean, we're, what, 7 or 8 months into this experiment? Can they point to anything and say, hey, we got this changed?
I think the biggest policy victory they've had so far is briefly shifting $2 million in additional funding from the police bureau to the Parks Department.
$2 million out of an $8 billion budget.
Which then was backfilled by some other money for the police bureau. So I don't know that you can point to any hugely significant accomplishments so far, although...
Che Guevara, they're not, right?
Certainly, you can say that they are shaping the rhetoric in city council in a way that is very unfamiliar to a lot of longtime observers at the building. But, you know, it's the 21st century, and rhetoric is shifting everywhere, as far as I can tell.
Is it doing anybody any good? Least all, if they say it has long served the wealthiest, I'd agree with you. I mean, there was a time where the entire city council lived on the west side of the Willamette River, where 18% of the population lives, and none of them lived on the east side of the river, where, you know, 82% of the population lives, and, of course, the 18% on the west side are living in the most expensive neighborhoods. I'd agree with you there. But what have they actually done that benefited any of the downtrodden?
The one thing that they've done so far that I will immediately point to is that they have really increased the effort to put sidewalks into the communities, both in the southwest of the city and the east side of the city, that really badly need them. An effort that was always a lot of talk before, and we're actually seeing money headed toward it and more sidewalks being built. I do think that's something they deserve credit for.
Okay. And in the meantime, has anybody actually filed the Ethics Commission request to say, is it legal to hold a meeting where half the people in the meeting are not visible, their discussion is not visible to the public?
It's a complicated question that you're going to have to ask the Ethics Commission. I do know the answer, but I'm going to do something I don't usually do and not be forthcoming on that right now.
Really? You're going to keep a secret? Did somebody text you and tell you not to tell me the truth?
No one likes to text me. I'm so grumpy they don't text me because I text back such mean things.
I think we are heading into interesting territory, though, because, Aaron, imagine having this happen in the Oregon legislature, where the same public meeting rules apply, except that for a long time, using the pandemic as an excuse, they met out of public view. And they said, we're going to make all these deals. The public will find out about them once we make them public. But in the meantime, we're cutting deals left and right behind the scenes. You can find the story at WWeek.com. Coming up in a moment, how in the world did Washington State fall to number 36 in desirability as a place to live out of all 50 states in America? That's next, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Worried about Mark?
He has small-town politics with big-town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it's the honestly provocative talk version of the Lars Larson Show for the Pacific Northwest. For the Radio Northwest Network, I'm glad to be with you, and always glad to take your phone calls and your emails. This segment, it comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Now, our X poll today. Should all American cities take the Trump approach to homeless? You offer treatment, shelter, or jail, or none of the above, meaning you're not going to live on the streets anymore. Trump is showing how to get it done. I'm willing to bet that Washington, D.C. is going to show the changes very, very quickly. Should other American cities like Portland and Seattle adopt the same approach? I would say yes to the question. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. It's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. yesterday's poll. Should states empty out their prisons of illegal alien criminals by sending them home? And by home, I don't mean somewhere in America. I mean home as in your home country. You are not legally here. Well, the state of Oklahoma has decided to do that. Governor Kevin Stitt has ordered that about 500 nonviolent criminal aliens who are currently locked up in jails and prisons in Oklahoma are going to be turned over to ICE to be sent back to their home countries. I think it's a great approach. I think it would send a message as well. 92% of you said yes to that idea, and I voted yes as well. Only 8% of you said no to the idea of doing that. Now, I wanted to mention a couple of things that are going on in Seattle. There was a shooting on the Seattle waterfront. It happened this week, and apparently it involved a confrontation. A man in a wheelchair, who's apparently a regular musician down on the Seattle waterfront, where they just spent about $800 million to remodel and make the place look beautiful again. This guy apparently goes down there on a regular basis, and he plays music and apparently gets donations. Another man walked up, and there was some allegation of stolen valor against the man in the wheelchair. That's what the man who confronted him said. Now, I'll get details on that as they're available. That's all we know at this point. Then the man in the wheelchair, well, he was sitting there, and the guy who walked up and confronted him about alleged stolen valor. That's when you put yourself forward as a veteran of the military when, in fact, you are not. I don't know whether the guy has engaged in stolen valor or not. But the man who confronted the man in the wheelchair then ripped a patch off his wheelchair and began to walk away quickly. The man in the wheelchair wheeled after him in this electric wheelchair, then reached into his shirt and pulled out a gun. There are multiple videos of the incident that happened on the Seattle waterfront. And at that point, when the man in the wheelchair pulled out a gun, which turned out to be an airsoft pistol, but I don't think that matters, the other man who had confronted him, who was standing about 20 feet away, pulled his own gun, which was real, not an airsoft, and fired one shot. The man in the wheelchair was shot, but he survived the shooting. He is apparently going to recover. The man who pulled his gun, apparently in response to that threat, is sitting in jail. He's being held on a $750,000 bail, and his attorney indicates that this will be a self-defense case. Now, the King County Prosecutor's Office, I think, is being a bit idiotic. Because they said any time you begin a confrontation, then you lose your right to self-defense. I've talked to lawyers about this issue before. That is not the case. I mean, imagine this. Imagine you walk out into the parking lot of your apartment building where you pay extra to have an assigned parking space. Say somebody is parked in that parking space, and the person who owns the car that's parked in your space, you say to them, please move your car. You're parked in my space. And the guy says, I'm not going to do it. And you say, no, I demand that you move your car. You've begun the confrontation. If the man who has his car parked in your space, who's refusing to do anything, and you've confronted him, if he then pulls out a gun, then you haven't lost your rights to self-defense. I'm not a lawyer, but I've talked to plenty of lawyers about it. It may diminish that claim. If you've gone up and started a fight, and then you start to get the worst of that fight, and then you pull out a gun and shoot somebody, you may have a problem. In this case, the man was arrested, the man who did the shooting with the real gun, and he is now sitting in jail, and he's facing charges of robbery, apparently for taking the patch from the man in the wheelchair. I do want to mention this. The fact that you've got so much crime and violence that's going on in both Oregon and Washington may be one of the reasons that Wallet Hub, which is an outfit that keeps an eye on where the best places to live in America are. California is now 32nd in America. And you say, boy, California has fallen a long way. Well, Washington State is worse. Washington State now ranks number 36 out of 50 in terms of the best places to live. Oregon comes in at 39th on that list. They say that rapid growth in Seattle and outstretching the infrastructure of the cities has made it not as nice a place to live. Where is number two? That would be Idaho. Idaho ranks as number two. Seattle, or Washington, ranks as number 36. And Oregon ranks at 39th. Now, what does that tell you about whether or not the folks who are sitting in public office are actually making good decisions about how to maintain the livability of either of the two states? Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. I'll get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. I'll bet that as many state fairs as you've ever been to, and I've been to a number of state fairs in different states. I've been to the one in Alaska. I've certainly been to the Oregon State Fair. I've been to the Washington State Fair. I can't think of any others right now. Did you ever think that partisan politics and discrimination against conservatives would play a role in the Washington State Fair? I'm going to tell you what's happening right now. We had reached out to the Pierce County Republican Party, and we'd also reached out to the Washington State Republican Party. So far, no response. But it seems that for the first time in many years, the Pierce County Republican Party will not have a booth at the Washington State Fair. Now, as the Center Square points out, the people in Puyallup, which is where the fair is held, actually call it the Puyallup Fair. But it does, in fact, have the official moniker of Washington State Fair. I'll get into the details of what they're doing here. I think this is nothing that, more than partisan politics and, to some extent, hatred for the orange man. And that would be President Donald Trump. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we love naysayers on this show. We will put you right to the front of the line as long as you can get in, explain what it is that you disagree about, and then stick around for a couple of questions from me. Our X poll question today, and we put up a brand new one every day. Should all American cities take the Trump approach to homeless? And that is, offer them treatment, shelter, or jail. But you don't get to keep living on the streets. Now, I think that kind of approach is one that the liberals and the Democrats are going to scream and yell about. He says he wants to clean up Washington, D.C. And he's got authority to do that because Washington, D.C. is not a city like every other city in America. Every other city in America is a creation of the legislature of the state that that city is in. Washington, D.C. is a creation of the United States Congress. And the United States Congress can take it back anytime they want. Now, I know that Washington, D.C. has made noises for decades about wanting to become its own state. I think we've been sensible in saying, no, you are not going to be a state. You are not going to have representation, full representation, in the U.S. Senate or the House. And in fact, you can imagine why that would be problematic. Every other one of the states is entitled to two U.S. senators and a number of representatives based on the population of that state. But Washington, D.C., that's the seat of government. No, they don't get a special privilege to do that. And if they want to be part of a state, Washington, D.C. itself was created out of parts of other states that are next door, nearby. And if they want to become part of a state, the people who live there can move to an actual state like Virginia or like Maryland, or they can say, we're going to give up the land, let it be reabsorbed into those states. I don't think that's likely, but that's another way to make it happen. Well, what Donald Trump has said is that when it comes to homeless people, they can go to shelters, they can go to treatment, or they can go to jail, but they're not going to be living on the streets. I suggest that if every American city took that same approach, saying, finally, we are tired of this situation. It is problematic for the addicts who are living on the streets. It's dangerous. It is dangerous for other people on the streets because homeless drug addicts living on the street commit crimes. They take drugs. They sometimes kill each other. They sometimes attack each other. And sometimes the homeless attack the non-homeless, the ones of us who have homes. And in that case, that is absolutely outrageous. And the idea that has become a place where criminals actually hide. You'd be amazed when the police go out to a homeless encampment and they start to run people for their background and find out if there are wants or warrants on them. Oftentimes, they find accused criminals who've decided that living in a homeless camp is a great way to live just a little bit below the radar. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show on X, also on our website at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, about the state fair, otherwise known as the Puyallup Fair, the Center Square did a good job of reporting on this story. The Pierce County Republican Party, as I said, I reached out to them this morning. Nobody was available to talk, but they have done signature gathering for citizen initiatives, and they have sold GOP merchandise. And in fact, that's what you'd expect to see at just about any county fair. You would expect to see that you're going to see shirts and hats and bumper stickers and things like that. Except the Washington State Fair officials have told the Pierce County Republican Party, you're going to have to relocate to a different area. And then the spokesperson for the Washington State Fair says long-standing rules do not allow signature gathering or political merchandise sales in the marketplace buildings in order to help maintain the guest experience. I want to ask you something. I've never been to a county fair or a state fair that did not include a fair amount of politicking. I mean, you run into political candidates, there are people giving speeches, there are people handing out leaflets, there are people gathering signatures on petitions. To me, that, along with the farm exhibits and the concert at night and the Star Spangled Banner, let's hope, in many cases, that's part of the fair experience. Well, Dave McMullen, who's the chair of the Pierce County Republicans, he told the Center Square that what got the controversy started is during the Washington State Spring Fair when somebody complained about an ICE flag that was displayed at the Pierce County Republican Party booth. Well, they took the flag down within an hour, but where's the problem there? We all understand that it's the GOP that backs Customs Enforcement, ICE. We all understand the Democrats don't like ICE because they see illegal aliens as part of their constituency. Republicans do not see them as part of their constituency. McMullen also said the party has always held signature gatherings at the fair, has always sold merchandise during the fair, and it's never been a problem. I mean, somebody coming to the Washington State Fair and saying, why, they've got Donald Trump T-shirts for sale. You just ruined my entire state fair experience. He said, we've been doing this for 5 or 6 years. We've been doing initiatives. We've been selling merchandise, and we've always done it inside a 10 by 30 booth in what's known as the Showplex. It's the most expensive area because it's the center of the state fair. They moved in there in 2022. And he says they met with fair officials to talk about their concerns. They don't want signature gathering, but he says their reasoning was nonsense. They tried to say, well, you can have information about initiatives at your booth, but you can't gather signatures. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. They wanted to send the initiatives over to what they called the free speech area, which is over by the backside of the state fairgrounds. I think this is the Washington State Fair, which is probably run by a bunch of Democrats. And the result is they don't want politics there. At least they don't want GOP politics there. Back in a moment, we're going to talk about drug prices. Coming up next, your phone calls and emails are welcome. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Summer is the...
Unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We call this the best conversation in talk journalism, and I intend to keep it that. If you want to join in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you first in line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. There's a piece of conventional wisdom that says that Americans pay some of the highest prescription drug prices in the world. And it turns out that that's not true. And in fact, it turns out it's very easy to understand why it's not true, but I have to detail for you why it's not true, and it has some significance to it. In fact, in some ways, for most of the drugs that Americans use, we pay some of the lowest prices in the world, so don't be led astray. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, if you want to join us, you can always call in. You can email talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X-Poll question, should all American cities take the approach that Donald Trump has named for Washington, D.C., dealing with the homeless, and that is you have three options: treatment, shelter, or jail. You do not have the option of continuing to live on the streets, which is both problematic for the homeless person, whether they're mentally ill, drug addicted, alcohol addicted. No matter what your circumstances are, it's not a good idea to be living on the streets. It's also potentially dangerous, both to the homeless person and the population that lives nearby. It's also problematic because when you have a whole bunch of drug addicts living in homeless camps, you can imagine it's a great opportunity for the people who sell illegal drugs. But that's the approach the president has taken. Shelters, treatment, or jail, nothing in between. He says he's going to clean up the nation's capital. He plans to displace homeless people. Well, if you're moving them from living on the streets to treatment, shelter, or jail, in some ways I kind of expect to get a naysayer call on that saying, well, that's just mean. It's cruel. Really? You know what I think is cruel? I think it's cruel to leave human beings living in a tent on the street in the middle of either the August heat or in a few months in the cold of fall and winter. That's what I think is cruel. I think it's cruel to leave mentally ill people living on the streets instead of saying we're going to give you a set of options. One of them is treatment. One of them is shelter. And one of them is jail. And you can pick one of the three. But there is no other alternative. In any case, you can find the X-Poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Now, let me get back to prescription drug prices, because I found this fascinating. There's actually a brand new study out, and the group called Unleash Prosperity, which is it's a work of Steve Moore, who's an economist. Moore has done some work with President Trump. He's been on this show before. He's not here today. But he has a brand new study that was done by one of his colleagues named Thomas Phillipson. Thomas Phillipson is an American economist who served as the acting chair of the Council of Economic Advisers in the previous Trump administration. And what did he do? He went out and he took a hard look at what it costs to buy prescription drugs. Now, you are probably accustomed to seeing lots and lots of news stories that say why Americans pay some of the highest drug prices in the world. Well, it turns out that's not true. Now, he admits what is true is that if you're talking about the latest, greatest miracle cures for whatever it is that ails you, I mean, the newly developed drugs that cost an average of $2 to $3 billion to get to the marketplace. In other words, when you have folks working in a lab and they come up with what they think is a promising new treatment of some kind of pill or a shot or whatever it happens to be. And no, I'm not talking about the mRNA jab. That's a whole subject for another day. But when they come up with something new, it takes on average about 12 years to both find the new treatment, refine it so that it's safe and so it's effective, and then get it through the FDA approval process. It usually takes longer than a decade. Now, of course, the clock is already running. When it comes to a patented drug, the clock is running whether you can sell the drug or not. So when it finally gets to market after 10 or 12 years, and then they go out to sell it, they have to figure out how many of these are we likely to sell, pills or shots, and how much money are we going to have to charge to be able to try to recover the $2 to $3 billion that we spent on developing it? Now, Do you know how much of the drug marketplace in America is made up of those brand new, still under patent miracle cures? About 7%. The other 93% of prescription drugs in America, 93% are generics. In other words, they're drugs that have been on the marketplace long enough. They're no longer under patent. They are available in generic form. And it turns out that this study by Thomas Philipson shows that the United States has the biggest generic drug market share in the world. It is 93%. Well, what does that mean? It means that for most of the things, and I'll admit I have a bit of a dog in the fight on this one, I take metformin every day. It helps regulate my blood sugar because I have type 2 diabetes. Not a big deal. And in fact, made in quantity, I think metformin costs about a nickel. It might cost a dime for every pill. So if you went out with no insurance or anything else and bought a year's supply of it, it probably wouldn't set you back $50. And of course, with insurance, they sell it for a bit more. But again, the costs are almost nothing. You think about common treatments for blood sugar, high blood pressure, all kinds of other ailments that afflict people. You're going to buy the generic in many, many cases. People do tend to buy the generic. Now, there are doctors who occasionally will say, we want to get that brand name stuff. Either because the doctor goes on golf outings with the pharmaceutical company, and I would be lying if I said that doesn't happen, or it may be because your doctor says this particular version of it is very, very good and avoids some of the side effects. Now, how much do Americans pay for generic drugs? Well, you'd say, well, we pay the most. No, we don't. Apparently, Medicare and Medicaid both pay about 20% less for generic prescription drugs than Europe, Canada, and the UK. 20% less. It is true, as they say in the study, that Americans pay more for the patented drugs, the ones that are still under patent protection. But that only lasts so long. But residents of countries with socialized medicine don't have access to those drugs. They can't even buy them at any price. In fact, I've told you stories before about people who come up with a particular ailment and they're told, yeah, there's a cure for that. Okay, I'd like to get it. And maybe they're in Great Britain and they're told, I'm sorry, the National Health Service, the NHS, doesn't carry that, doesn't offer it. And they say, well, where can I buy it on my own? And they tell them, I'm sorry, you're in a socialized medicine country. You aren't allowed to buy that on your own. You have to get it through the NHS. And then the NHS says it's not available. So they don't have access at all to some of those drugs at any price. And when it comes to generic drugs, Americans pay about 20% less for those generic prescription drugs than people in the rest of the world. It's only the patented ones and the ones that are still under patent protection, and that runs out after a number of years, and it's not that long a period of time. American companies spend billions to come up with the breakthrough drugs. In many cases, if you're in Canada or you're in Great Britain, you can't put your hands on them for any amount of money. And when you go out and buy the generic drugs for the regular stuff, the day-to-day stuff, it turns out it's a whole lot cheaper to buy it in the U.S. of A. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Do you realize you can literally have Lars with you all day, every day? Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, and we talk about education a lot. As you know, the region collectively spends billions of dollars. I think you could even say tens of billions if you count Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and yet it produces very poor results, and they're constantly claiming that they're broke. So I thought we'd talk about that with Vicki Murray, who's director of the Center for Education and the Paul Locke Research Fellow for Education and Washington Policy. Vicki, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Can you help me sort this out for my audience? Because I'm not smart enough. Washington State is spending close to $20,000 per student per year for ordinary K-12 public education. I mean, it sounds like a university tuition bill, but it's not. $20,000 per student, and yet they can't afford the money for music and art programs. Can you help me help my audience understand why that's the case?
Absolutely. It's baffling. And as someone who's moved here, I live in Seattle from Arizona, I look at these per pupil expenditures, and I have to tell you, most of the United States of America would give, you know, limbs to be able to spend that much per pupil. But here's what's going on. Two things. The first problem is that money doesn't follow the student. So about, on average, around $20,000 per student. A lot of that money goes into different silos. So you could have a lot of money tied up for construction or some sort of dedicated program, yet you need money over here, and districts don't have the ability to switch those funds. The second problem is that there's virtually no incentive to use the money well. If you look at the historical data as to where the money is being spent, it's going to administration. The rise in the percentage of administrators is blowing student enrollment and, you know, the increase in teachers out of the water. So we've got a lot of disproportion, but there are solutions.
Well, in fact, one of the things I've always asked, Vicki, and I know I'll probably get superintendents hating me for saying this, but when I look at schools from a distance, for the most part, the schools are in locations that have been bought and paid for a long time. You know, they have a school.
Yeah.
They've owned it for maybe decades. Some of them might even be close to 100 years old. And they seem to wear schools out very quickly. They'll decide every 20 or 30 years they need to build a brand new school. You know, whereas I know private companies that have been in the same building, now they may have remodeled it a bit, but they don't go out and build brand new buildings every couple of years. Even Nike, even Microsoft, even Boeing don't do that because it's a foolish use of money. So if you've got bought and paid for bricks and mortar, and then you've got employees, most of whom are represented by labor unions, and they have multiple year contracts, you know, that specify how you're hired, how you're fired, how much you're paid, what your benefits are. Those are all decided. What exactly does a superintendent do?
It's a very good question, because they are supposed to ensure policies and procedures that are supposed to support student learning and student achievement.
Right.
Sadly, that's not what happens. The argument that we're given, because if you look at superintendent salaries, and it's mind-numbing, we're talking over $250,000, $500,000, just in base salaries, depending on how big the school district is. And the justification is, well, superintendents are like public sector CEOs, and you have to attract the best and the brightest.
But that's it. And I kind of took a long way to get at it. But when you have a private sector CEO, he may have to decide on opening and closing different market. You know, he may say, I'm the head of Target stores or some other company. We're going to close those stores. We're going to open up new stores over here. We're going to hire these people. We're going to fire those people. We're going to change our product mix. A superintendent is sitting there. He doesn't get on his own the ability, or she, to say, we're going to close down those schools. In fact, the community usually pitches a fit anytime they talk about doing it. So I'm not sure what it is they're actually deciding or doing.
Well, that's one of the problems. And I've had the privilege of working with superintendents that actually did get or presidents of boards and superintendents did get the job done. And that's their number one complaint. We do not have enough control to hire and fire the people to get it done. There's a culture. But tell you what, the big problem is we have a monopoly in schooling. So I've got to tell you that if parents were free to vote with their feet and take their children and put them in, you know, in different schools, we would shift the incentive structure. There'd be really powerful incentives to support student learning and school productivity.
Well, and for example, you gave a list. Edmond School District superintendent earns over a third of $1 million a year. That may include benefits, or maybe benefits are on top of that. Then they've got deputy or assistant superintendents, two of them. those three salaries alone consume over $1 million a year. So apparently the superintendent, Rebecca Miner, is so busy making all the decisions. She can't, you know, how she hires people, how she fires people, what she pays them are all spelled out in a contract that is negotiated for years. And then she has to have two deputy superintendents, and then they have other directors or supervisors or other assistant superintendents, all making about $250,000 a year. And then they have school principals. And again, with the school principal, I've been told by principals before, I don't get to fire people. I don't get to hire people. I don't really get to make much in the way of changes at all. Well, then what are you doing for $200,000 a year? What is the decision making that we ordinarily pay people six-figure salaries to make decisions? What decisions does, say, a school principal make?
Well, these days, it's all about regulatory compliance. You want to know why all this money is going to everything but education? It's because government has become so involved and so micromanaging of schools. The solution is to just be let schools be completely transparent, give them and parents freedom to pick what you want to do, let schools and districts put their best foot forward and compete for students. That's when we'd see programs, if you want arts programs, you want music programs, enrichment programs that support student learning, that's what you would get. But parents are not calling the shots. Parents don't want all this admin and government regulation. That's the problem. And by the way, need to know about the new federal tax credit, that it's for schools that really are hard up for money. You can have tax credit donations, as long as the governor opts us into the program.
And that's the question. Has Ferguson indicated, because I know the teachers union is probably threatening to, you know, to lynch him if he signs on to the thing. But if he doesn't sign on to it, he's denying citizens in Washington state any kind of access to the program, isn't he?
Absolutely. Hasn't made that decision yet. U.S. Treasury is going to come out with the final rulemaking, you know, by the end of this year. But here's the thing. Teachers union, it doesn't matter what the teachers unions want. If public school districts and parents want to participate in the program, there are over 450 public school foundations here in Washington right now. Imagine if Washington taxpayers could get a little bit of a break when it comes to taxes, contribute to schools they believe in, and schools could pay for programs like arts and music and all sorts of other programs, special education. Why would the union stand in the way of that? I think that's the question.
Because they like the monopoly?
Well, that's the answer. It's not a good answer, but guess what?
Yeah.
Here's a chance where public schools, private schools, faith-based schools are no longer in competition with each other. You like your school, support your school, and let's take the politics out of it and just give students every possible learning option we can think of.
I think you're right. That's Vicki Murray from the Washington Policy Center. By the way, imagine Bob Ferguson telling the teachers union, I'm going to sign on to school choice, and they say, and we're not giving a dime to your reelection campaign. You've got the Lars Larson Show. If you're even.
He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Now, think about this. I think that the Democrats have fallen into a major trap. I watched Chris Matthews on MSNBC talking about this just today. He said Trump has laid a trap, because what Donald Trump said was there's too much violent crime going on in Washington, D.C. I think he's finally realized that one of the things that Democrats have done that we joked about before is that whatever Donald Trump says, if Donald Trump looks out and says, why, that's a beautiful blue sky, the Democrats feel absolutely compelled to contradict him. No, it's a dark, stormy sky. It's practically black and gray. even though it might actually be blue. They feel an instinctual reaction that they have to disagree. Whatever Donald Trump says is, they have to say it is not. So, case in point, Washington, D.C. Trump says the place is too violent, there's too much crime, and he says, I'm going to go out and clean it up. And, you know, it's funny because most of the Democrats don't seem to have read the laws that regulate that. The president has the authority to take over the Metro D.C. Police Department, and he's done exactly that. He has the authority to call up the National Guard. He has the authority, and he has. He has the authority to send FBI agents and U.S. Marshals out on the streets of Washington, D.C. In fact, just yesterday, they made 23 arrests in day one of the increased emphasis on law enforcement in Washington, D.C. So what do the Democrats do instinctively? They say, no, Washington, D.C., it's not dangerous at all. There is not a lot of crime in Washington, D.C. And consider this. You will hear people say, why, Washington, D.C. is not even the number one or number two city for murder in America. No, it's not number one or number two. It's number three. Oh, okay, so it's still pretty bad. Well, they can't afford to admit that. So what they do is they say, no, Washington, D.C. is perfectly safe. They have fallen into the trap. Whatever it is Trump says, they have to say the opposite. Now, I want to know, when you hear people like the mayors of Portland and Seattle, when you see the governors of both states, and Tina Kotek has sounded off on this, I believe Bob Ferguson has as well, and he's a former attorney general, you would think that he would be smarter than to do that kind of thing. And they come out and they say, why? This is Trump trying to set the precedent to be able to send law enforcement into Seattle and Portland. Well, the fact is, federal law enforcement was sent into Portland. And when did they send them in? When Portland saw 100 nights of downtown riots that pretty well had the downtown area taken back to the point where real estate is down dramatically. A building that sold just a decade ago for about a third of $1 billion, $360 million, just sold for $45 million. It basically was a 9-to-1 reduction in price. And downtown vacancies are gone. Downtown foot traffic is gone. And then you feel the Democrats who say, we have to say something to contradict this man. Consider how this man might have reacted, Val Mahoney. Val Mahoney makes his home on the east side of the state of Washington in a town called Davenport. I've actually driven through Davenport. I think I even stopped there for a bit, especially if it had an antique store. If Tina was in the car, you know we stopped in Davenport, Washington. So what happened? This man got sick. He needed to get some cancer treatment. Some of the best cancer doctors are, of course, at the cancer centers in Seattle. So he went to Seattle to get his treatment. He had his car parked out front of his friend's home, and he had only been there one day. He was on day one of his medical appointments, and what happened? His car got stolen. Now, he said he'd lived in Seattle for 25 years. He was staying with one of his friends in the Columbia City neighborhood to begin treatment for his cancer, and his car gets stolen almost immediately. I told you earlier on the show today, a man was shot on the downtown waterfront, the just renovated, bright and shiny $800 million waterfront that Seattle just finished making over. I mean, the place has become notorious for the kinds of outrageous crimes that happen, the homeless encampments, the drug dealing, and the whole nine yards. They've had major homegrown companies like Amazon that actually decided to pull out of locations like Third and Pine. And why? Because the place has become too dangerous. But instead of simply saying, well, if the president is going to clean up Washington, D.C., we can do better than he can. You know, that might actually be something that voters would listen to. If you say Donald Trump is going to clean up D.C., you could say, as the mayor of Portland or the mayor of Seattle, we're going to do an even better job with our city. We're not going to sit around. If Donald Trump does something, we'll do it better. Instead, what they say instead is, whatever Donald Trump says, we will contradict it, even if it makes you look like six kinds of idiot, to say there's no crime in Washington, D.C. There's not a crime problem. There's not a violence problem. There's not a murder problem. They have to contradict whatever the orange man says. And as Chris Matthews, who's a longstanding liberal guy on national media, I watched the video of him saying, yep, you fell into his trap. You decided that whatever it was that he said, you had to contradict it, and you did. You contradicted it, but it made you look like a real idiot. You fell into the trap. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson. Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And
Lars.
Now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails. You know, if you have an even passing familiarity with what the Supreme Court and its intersection with public education is, you'll remember the title Brown versus the Board of Education, where, you know, the courts and the rest of America finally realized, or finally did all those decades ago, that you can't have education that is based on the racial or skin color background of the students who are involved. You can't say these schools are only for white kids and these schools are predominantly for brown and black kids. You're not allowed to say the white kids get to go to the nice schools and the other kids get to go to the not so nice schools. That is illegal. It is unconstitutional, and it is just plain morally wrong, even if it didn't violate the law and the Constitution. And yet today they seem to have reinvented the idea and decided that funding for schools should be based on racial composition. Joshua Thompson joins me now, who's a senior attorney and director at the Pacific Legal Foundation and the Equal Opportunity Practice Group. Joshua, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Should I be surprised that there are schools that say we want to allocate the money for schools based on the color of the student?
Absolutely, you should be surprised. You should be surprised, outraged. It's morally repugnant, but nevertheless, it is true that there are schools that are determining how to fund their schools based on the racial composition of the student body.
So they're going to allocate more money in this case to schools with predominantly black or brown students and less money, consequently, to those with white students and perhaps Asian students as well, since these days the radical left likes to lump white people and Asians together and then brown and black together. What is your group at Pacific Legal going to do about that?
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is the Portland Public School District has a quote-unquote equity funding plan, and what this plan does is it allocates funding on a per pupil basis, as most school districts do, but it determines which the amount that each school will be funded based on the racial composition of the student body. So, and you're right to note that its definition of quote unquote historically underserved students excludes Asians, Middle Eastern students, Arab students, South Asian students, among others. And this results in a huge discrepancy. Now, I don't know my Portland schools that well, but I know that one school called Rosa Parks gets nearly $18,000 per student, while another school, another elementary school called Richmond, is under $8,000. So that's like a $10,000 per student difference. And this is just because one school has kids of a certain race and another school has kids of another race.
I mean, I can think of some great Joe Biden quotes, you know, where he says, I won't remember it exactly enough, but effectively he talked about education for both white kids and kids of color. But they're assuming that if you have a certain skin color, you must be disadvantaged. Isn't that a racist assumption in and of itself?
Of course it is, and it's such by lumping all students according to their racial groups, you're saying that in order for this policy to work, all black people, all brown people, all white people have to think and be alike. It's treating your individuality as irrelevant, but you are just a product of your own race. And this has real consequences. At one school, Abernathy Elementary School, they had to cut a reading program, a reading results program that was really producing results for kids that were laying back and reading, but because that school was on the wrong end of the funding mechanism, they had to cut their reading program for elementary kids. Let me add one other thing, Lars. It's not sure that these schools are 100% white or 100% Asian. There are Black and Hispanic kids at all schools throughout Portland. And yet, because of this funding mechanism, they leave these individual students out of the Black because the aggregate racial composition of these schools isn't what Portland views as historically underserved. It's outrageous.
Okay, and so that could actually compound the problem, because if you say this student is, say, predominantly, or this school is predominantly Black, say it's 60% or 70% of the students are Black students, well, that still means 30 or 40% of them are white students. Those students who are presumed to be advantaged because of their skin color are going to be going to a school with twice as much funding or more than twice as much funding as the school that's not. And the school that is seen as predominantly white, say it's 80% white, and they get shortchanged, they get the short end of the stick, that means the 20% or 30% of students of color at the predominantly white school are going to get the tiny amount of resources, so they get shortchanged at that end. So even if you assume that every student of color is disadvantaged and every white student has some kind of built-in advantage, it ends up working against students of color and white students as well, doesn't it?
Thousands of them, Lars. And this is the problem. It's a sordid business when you start divvying up people by race. And that is exactly what Portland's doing, and it's leaving thousands and thousands of kids worse off because they see fit to categorize and stereotype people according to these outmoded racial categories.
Okay, so as a lawyer, when you look at a case like this, if you're going to go against the Portland Public Schools, they must think that they have a legal mechanism by which they can get away with this. Do they? And how are they explaining this in a way that actually, you know, comports with the law?
Lars, I don't think there is any universe where the law stands today where a school funding program, the entire school funding mechanism that is hinges on the race of the schools could be upheld as constitutional. And I think they know that. I think what they're banking on is that there are no parents in the Portland Public School District that are willing to stand up and say that I'm not going to stand for this, and that we are going to enforce our constitutional rights, and we challenge this. And that's frankly, you asked me earlier, what is Pacific Legal Foundation doing about this? We want to find those parents that have had enough, that are willing to take a stand and stand up for their constitutional rights. I'm hopeful that we can find those parents, because a program like this is so blatantly unconstitutional. It's harming so many thousands of kids that it needs to be stopped, and it needs to be brought to the attention of all Portlanders.
Now, I take it at this point you haven't had a chance to dig into maybe the record that they made when they created these programs, because I assume the school board voted on it and said yes to this kind of garbage. So when they did they discuss these issues at all, saying we're going to shortchange this school because most of the students there are white? And did they even recognize that means we're going to be shortchanging all the kids at that predominantly white school? Did they take note of that?
Yeah, what they say is that we're trying to overcome inequity and institutional and structural racism, that, you know, white students have clearly outperformed Black students in the school district, and we need to change our funding mechanism to account for that. But those sort of like gross stereotypes of lumping people into these racial groups have been long recognized by the Supreme Court to be unconstitutional. But that is what, you know, if you were going to ask me what they're going to say that they believe in this nonsense, and that they believe that we have to overcome the structural racism that is inherent in Portland, that has been perpetuated for hundreds of years.
And they're going to do it by instituting more institutional racism. That's Joshua Thompson from the Pacific Legal Foundation. Joshua, thanks very much.
On demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've got a real horror story for you about modern medicine, not about a failure. In this case, the success, except the bill that came at the end of the whole experience was a shocker for one mom. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, boy, we love naysayers. We decided more than a quarter of a century ago that if somebody calls and says, hey, I disagree with the conclusions you're reaching, or words to that effect, my producers simply say, that's okay. You go first in line. You get to make your argument first. Tell Lars what you disagree with him about. Prove him wrong. And then just stick around for a couple of questions. Naysayers go to the head of the line has been one of our hallmarks for more than 25 years. We've also got the X-Poll. Now, every day, my producers and I come up with a question. I happen to write today's question because I saw what Donald Trump was doing in Washington, D.C. And, of course, as usual, the liberals are completely outraged. Why the very idea that Donald Trump would say about all those homeless people living on the streets. And the dirty little secret that most of the cartel news media, and that includes local TV, local radio, local newspapers, as well as the national media, they'd have you believe why all those people are just living on the streets because apartments cost too much. I kid you not. I mean, I've talked to politicians on this show where they'll say, well, you know, the rent went up a few hundred dollars after the pandemic and these people can't afford it. I want to ask you something. Have you ever walked past a homeless camp and see somebody nodding off from either heroin or fentanyl or what they thought was OxyContin or booze? Have you ever looked at them and say, that guy, he's just a couple of hundred dollars short of having a very nice apartment somewhere? Nobody draws that conclusion except Democrat politicians. I mean, the liberal politicians would have you believe somehow that if only there were some subsidies that would bring that apartment rent down by a couple hundred dollars, that all those people would be living in a decent apartment somewhere instead of in a tent. Have they not figured out it's the substance abuse problem? Yes, there are people out there who are mentally ill. And in many cases, that mental illness seems to have either been aided or abetted or caused by the use of illegal drugs and alcohol. And as a result, they act crazy. So what's Trump's approach that's going to completely outrage the political left in America? He said there are three choices. You have treatment, shelter, or jail. One, two, or three. You either take treatment, you get off the drug problems, you address the mental health problems, whatever they happen to be, you get some shelter, or you go to jail. You are not going to live on the streets anymore. And yet, I know that the Democrats are going to fall into this trick one more time. And I'm not saying that Trump's approach is not the right approach to the problem. It is. It actually addresses the problem. I mean, I've watched pretty close to five decades of American politicians who promised, we've got another plan to solve the homeless crisis. I mean, Barry Obama did that back in 2013, 12 years ago. And Barack Obama said, we will solve this problem in 10 years. Here's my idea. And they are still sticking with the idea. It's called Housing First. And it's been a colossal disaster. The effect has not been to eliminate homelessness. It's actually made it worse. Because all you did was say, why don't we take that homeless drug addict and give him a house, an apartment, a place to stay? And you say, aren't you still going to have a drug addict or a boozer who's in an apartment now? Yeah. Yeah. But then maybe someday he'll get off the booze or get off the drugs. It doesn't work. In any case, you can find the question, should all American cities use the Trump approach to homeless? And that is treatment, shelter, or jail. Find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, about that trip to the hospital. So, a mom by the name of Jessica Farwell, she happened to live in California. Her six-month-old son had an accident and ended up with some second-degree burns. Terrible. Frightening. So, she takes a 15-minute trip to the emergency room where the doctor said, well, these second-degree burns, we're going to have to send him to a burn unit. We don't have one here. So they load the child on a helicopter for a 15-minute ride. Now, I know helicopters. Helicopters generally at speed do about, even the medical ones will do about 140 or 150, 150 miles an hour, pretty fast. But a 15-minute ride, meaning the burn center was 30 or 40 minutes away. So they put him on the helicopter. That cost $90,000. And then when the helicopter arrived, it was one-third of a mile, about 1,800 feet from the hospital. But to move him from the helicopter, a medical helicopter, to the hospital, an ambulance had to be called. That cost, for a one-third of a mile ride to the hospital, another $10,000. And he was treated for second-degree burns. And if you want a sense of how bad the situation was for that little boy, 6 months old, he was discharged from the hospital the very next day. And when mom and baby got home, well, in a couple of weeks, they found a bill for $100,000. $100,000. Now, they even added a $600 waiting fee for nighttime service. I mean, she says they added every single extra charge they possibly could. Farwell says she was promised by the doctors that her insurance would cover the costs. They did not initially. Her insurance said, we're not even going to cover half of that $100,000. They said in total she would owe about $70,000. She said, I've called the hospital. I've called the ambulance company. She's quoted by ABC7. My insurance, I've called several times. It has been years, and they won't listen to me. They won't talk to me. They keep giving me a runaround. Now, I want you to contrast that with the fact that when 10 million illegal aliens came into this country over the last 4 years, what was one of the first things that Joe Biden and company did, and the blue states in America? They said, we're going to make all of these people eligible for Medicaid, the health insurance for the poor. And the federal law says nobody who is illegally in the country gets Medicaid, but the illegal aliens did. And it cost taxpayers hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Well, when ABC7 finally took the story of this woman, Jessica Farwell, who has insurance, who has a job, who has the ability to pay some of the bill, when they finally took it public after years, the insurance companies finally caved in and paid. Joe Biden's friends, well, hey, if you're in the country illegally and they've given you health insurance that's not free, it is paid for by somebody else, meaning the taxpayers, you get whatever you want. And whether you get a bill in the mail or not doesn't really matter. If you get a bill from the hospital for $100,000 and you're illegally in the United States and you don't have that money, there's nothing much they can do to you. And in the meantime, the taxpayers and every other person who uses America's medical system is going to pay even higher costs because we have to pay the cost for things like this. And it sounds like foolish decisions like saying, we're going to put your kid in a helicopter to go 15 minutes or maybe 40 miles away, and then we're going to have a $10,000 ambulance ride to go a third of a mile to the hospital. If any of that makes sense to you, I'd love to hear the naysayer call. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larsen Show. OutdoorStewards.org. To all the wokey snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larsen Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails in a moment. First, I want to talk to Hans von Spakowski from the Heritage Foundation. This shows you the absolutely tenacious hold that some of these swamp creatures in Washington, D.C. have on the positions that they hold. When you have a brand new president who's elected, and as Hans points out, within minutes of taking the oath of office, says, I'm going to change this person out, Rochelle Garza. And she is still hanging on and refusing to leave. Hans, is it really that bad?
Well, yeah, it is. And what we're talking about is the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And Rochelle Garza is basically a woke DEI warrior of the left. And she was appointed to be the chair of the commission by the prior president. And when Donald Trump came in, he said, well, I'm de-designating you. You remain a commissioner, but you're no longer the chair. In fact, I'm designating a different commissioner, a guy named Peter Kersenow, as the chair. And they have to have a vote of the commission to approve that. And what did Garza do? She refused to hold a meeting to approve him becoming the chairman. And she's continued to act as if she is the chair. The president also has the ability to designate the staff director, which is basically the top, you know, career person at the commission. That also has to be approved in a vote by the commission, and Garza refuses to do that too. So, you know, this is just typical of the kind of behavior. And by the way, she criticizes the president all the time on Twitter, and she has been trying to recruit volunteers inside the federal government to oppose the president's policies of getting rid of DEI and discriminatory hiring and all that. So she's basically working against the president.
Okay, and I want you to make it clear to people why they hear commission, U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and they say, okay, how does this apply to me? It really could have an effect on almost any company, any job, any part of our society, could it not?
Yeah, it does. They have a loud voice when it comes to policies on discrimination. And when liberals have controlled the commission, like Garza, they are constantly holding hearings and issuing reports claiming all kinds of discrimination when there's no discrimination actually occurring. You know, they're the ones who want discrimination, for example, in college admission policies. You know, they were very much against the Supreme Court saying, no, you can't do that. So who sits on that commission is very important, and this is one of the worst people on there.
And by the way, could Trump actually remove her as a commissioner, or just remove her as the chair of the body?
Well, in fact, you know, that's an issue that's going to end up before the Supreme Court, because, you know, he has removed the commissioners of other federal agencies like the National Labor Relations Board. You've had district court judges, liberal ones, telling him, oh, you can't do that. They have a set term. And the president said, no, these folks were appointed by a president. A president can remove them. And so far, the Supreme Court has issued emergency stays upholding the president's ability to get rid of these people. Look, the president's the head of the executive branch. For Congress to set up agencies within the executive branch and restrict the president's ability to say who's supposed to head them or to supervise an executive branch agency is just makes no sense. Plus, it's not constitutional. That issue is going to end up before the Supreme Court before too long.
Well, yeah, because all of these agencies had to be created by an act of Congress. And when they did,
that's right,
they said, this is what it's made up of, this is what its job is, and this is who names the people who go into it. They gave the authority to the president. On what basis are the federal judge, are the lower federal judges saying, well, the president isn't allowed to decide who works in an executive branch agency? What kind of legal logic are they using?
Well, they're claiming that when these folks get appointed, and particularly where agencies heads have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, that once they're in, if they're in a set term, say 6 years, why the president can't remove them prior to that. But again, those kind of restrictive rules that are put into the law by Congress, I think, are patently unconstitutional. When you work in the executive branch, you you work at the pleasure of the president, and the president should be able to fire you for any reason or no reason at all.
Well, I mean, there are a number of people who've had agents. I mean, you know, in theory, the FBI director is for a 10-year term, is it not? Or isn't he?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
And yet, if you were to say you're the head of the executive branch, but we've locked in all the members of the executive branch, and if, you know, since we know that we're not likely to go through a stretch where we have, say, 12 years of Republican presidents, you could literally lock people into position or into terms that would eclipse any Republican who happens to take office. And you'd basically take the president of the other party and say every time a Democrat comes in, we'll put people in these long-term positions, and then if a Republican happens to get in, they'll just find themselves locked out of making any real decisions.
Right, and those Democratic appointees will do everything they can to thwart the policies, priorities, and administration of that Republican president, and that's exactly what has been going on. That's what happened. That's what's going on with this woman, Rochelle Garza, and that's why the president has actually fired Biden appointees at other agencies, all of whom have sued him, trying to say, oh, you can't get rid of us, even though it's now your administration.
So what happens next on this one with Garza? Is there a next step on this, or do we just have to wait until the courts act?
Well, supposedly there's a meeting scheduled in September at which there should be a vote, if she allows it to happen, on the new chair designated by the president. If they refuse to hold that meeting, if they refuse to approve the president's designee, well, then I think there are going to be lawsuits filed, and we'll see what they do to take these commissioners out.
Hey, Hans, I want to ask you, while I've got your ear, I want to know what you think. I think I watched Chris Matthews this morning saying they've fallen into Donald Trump's trap, and he's a hardcore lefty, but he's saying Trump goes to clean up Washington, D.C., and all the Democrats instinctively say, whatever Trump's doing, it's bad, and we'll just deny that there's a crime problem in D.C., and he said, you're falling into his trap. You're saying that, no, there's no crime problem when Americans can easily see there is.
Yeah, they are making the same mistake they're making when they've come out to support illegal criminal aliens, and now they're supporting criminals in Washington, D.C. I mean, look, that's why their polling numbers are the lowest ever in the history of the polls, looking at the popularity of the parties, because they keep doing that. It's so foolish. It's hard for me to believe that they are that politically, frankly, dumb in what they're doing.
Well, I'm anxious to see what voters do. If the Democrats want to campaign next year and say, you know, Kilmar Abrego Garcia of El Salvador is our hero, or Rochelle Garza is our hero, or maybe the criminals of Washington, D.C., they're our heroes, would you please cast your vote for us? I have a feeling it's not going to work out the way they think it does. That's Hans von Spakovsky, who's senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Back in a moment. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
You are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And our ex-poll today, here's the question. Should all American cities take the Trump approach that Donald Trump is taking with Washington, D.C.? He says, we're not only going to stop the high level of crime that's happening in Washington, D.C., and he's taken over control of the Metro D.C. police agency, which under federal law, which is what created D.C., he has the authority to do for up to 30 days. He's also said we're going to clean up the homeless problem as well. And I think when he does a bang-up job of doing that, Can you imagine if there are some enterprising reporters out there who will actually walk up to, say, the mayor of Seattle or the mayor of Portland and say, hey, this approach in D.C. seems to be cleaning up the problem very effectively. Have you considered doing the same? I want somebody to ask Bruce Harrell that. I'd ask him myself, but Mayor Harrell of Seattle does not have the guts to come on this show. Mayor Keith Wilson actually came on this program some time ago, and he assured us that he'd always be willing to come back on and take tough questions. You know what? He hasn't been back since. But wouldn't I love to ask Keith Wilson? This is a guy who actually campaigned on the idea that he would reduce the homeless problem in Portland, and he'd do it quickly. He'd do it within a year. Well, he hasn't. It doesn't seem to be working. And Trump is now taking the approach. To the homeless, they will offer three choices: treatment, shelter, or jail. One of those three. And when he gets it done, is anybody going to ask, say, Mayor Harrell or Mayor Wilson, are you willing to do the same thing? It seems to work in Washington, D.C. And what are they going to say? No, we don't like the idea because it's that orange guy that did it, and we don't like him. In any case, glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Our X poll question today: should all American cities, including those here in the Northwest, take the Trump approach to homeless, treatment, shelter, or jail? Today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, yesterday's X poll went this way: should states empty their prisons of illegal alien criminals? So these are people not being held pending charges. They're being held as convicted criminals. Should these states empty their prisons of illegal aliens and send them back to their home countries by handing them off to ICE? Well, Kevin Stitt, the governor of Oklahoma, is doing exactly that. They figure they will initially be able to return about 500 convicted criminals who are also illegal aliens if they are nonviolent. If they are nearing the end of their term of in prison, that all Oklahoma has to do is call up ICE, say, come on down, round them up. Here's 500 of them. Send them home. And they are now seeing thousands of deportation flights that are taking illegals out of the country. Well, what was the result of that question? 92% of you agreed with the idea of states emptying their prisons of illegal aliens. Only 8% of you were naysayers. Glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. I did want to say something about this, and that is, has anybody thought about the fact that your latest power bills are going up by double digits here in the Pacific Northwest? And it's funny because finally, the cartel media, in this case, Cairo News, the CBS affiliate out of Seattle, is saying the feds say the cost of electricity in Washington state is now 12.5% higher than it was just 1 year ago. That is almost twice as big an increase for Washington state as for the rest of the country. And why? Because of all those crazy green policies. Let's go to Anthony. Hey, Anthony, thanks for listening and thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Lars. You know, you're bringing up a point of what President Trump's doing there in D.C. I agree with you to a point. However, I think we could do one step better because we know these governed Democrat states aren't going to take it upon themselves to do the accountable thing.
Anthony, is your phone fading out on you? If you can step toward a window, because it just faded and I lost you. Are you still there?
Here's what we... Yeah. Hello.
Go for it.
Okay, yeah, so yeah, I think you should take everybody to the White House and have the press there and say, okay, this is what I'd like you all to do, who's on board, and then have those governors step up and say, yeah, I'm going to, you know, take something from your playbook to straighten out my city. I don't know if they'll do that or not, though.
I think, you know, that's a great approach. You might even couple it with there are various organizations like the, there are organizations of state governors. Usually, I don't think the Democrat governors want to have anything to do with Trump. The Republicans do. But can you imagine if Trump showed up at a meeting of, say, Western governors? There is a Western Governors Association. Show up at the meeting unannounced and say, hey, I'm here to find out if you're willing to do the same thing I was able to do to clean up Washington, D.C. Will you do that in your own city? And if you won't, would you mind explaining to the TV cameras why you don't want to do it? It worked for us to do it. You could do the same.
Bringing the public is the way to go and letting America know kind of like exactly where the left stands or where the Democrat governor stands. We got, you know, the idea is to get the Democrats either on board or got to get them out of office because they're destroying the states that they're running.
You're absolutely right. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, while I was disappointed in Schwarzenegger at the end as governor of California, one of the things he'd do, he'd go to the legislature and say, change the law. And they'd say, no, we're not going to do it. He'd say, fine, we'll take it to a ballot measure and let the public vote on it. They only had to be humiliated a couple of times by that kind of technique to be able to get something done. Anthony, thanks for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.